2014, Shibra by Neuberger, End of Life Issues. You're live now. A few weeks ago when I was in Los Angeles, I was impressed that the community there had, over the course of, I think yesterday and today, maybe the day before, had several days of learning, had a more seder for an hour or two, a few shiurim, and had a very, very terrific PR. And this is a few weeks ago. So I had in mind that this would be a good thing to have in our own community. But then I got back and I got involved and I answered my phone calls and then forgot about this plan. So I'm very grateful that Rav Elchanan Grunewald and Rav Tanachum Cohen had this idea and then brought it to Josh, and Josh made it go mikoyach lepoyel. And so I'm grateful for Josh for putting it together in a very short period of time. And for the opportunity to learn these halachas together. Rabbi Grunewald told me that he says every halacha, Kadosh Baruch Hu is Torah full of halachas, every halacha has a schus, has a merit that it should be learned sometime. So we hope that by learning it in theory, so it won't never have to be learned in practice. The practical issues at hand, I think a year ago, perhaps maybe 2 years ago, we discussed the writing of a shtar chatzi zocher, which is a document that allows a person to halachically put into effect everything they want to happen in terms of their material goods and material wealth. And we know the halachas are very specific as to who's supposed to inherit parents and family, the achar mei v'esm shana, and very often we think that would not be good for the family. We often think it would not be good for the family that the bechor should take double. We sometimes think it would not be good for the family that the girls should be dependent on their husband's income and their husband's material legacy and not have a share in the parents. And therefore, the shtar chatzi zochar, what we call the halachic will, is able to, again, bring one's, what one wants to happen, bring it, make it halachically viable and halachically practical. What we're focusing in on this morning is what's called advanced health care directives. That when if a person, Rachmana Litzlan, is suffering various diseases, which Rachmana Litzlan can rob a person of his decision-making ability. And at that point, the question is, what takes over then? So very often, hopefully the next of kin will take over. Sometimes, if the next of kin are not either present or they're not attentive, then it's the culture of the hospital will take over. And the culture of the hospital varies from hospital to hospital, often from practice to practice. And what is the wisdom of the medical of the medical team is often not in sync with what we would want, and therefore by having an advanced health care directive, one can maintain some measure of control. In addition, sometimes there will be disputes amongst the children, amongst the next of kin, and by a person expressing what they want to happen, they can often bring the family together and make it easier on the family, and then try to the extent that one can make happen what one would want to happen. Sometimes the family is under enormous pressure from the culture of the hospital. Sometimes the various doctors will weigh in, and even the family stands strong that they want certain care to take place, so they can get worn down whenever any new specialist gets involved and expresses what often is a current cultural approach. So it often becomes much more difficult for the family to stand whatever position they want to take. by having something in writing from the chol himself that can often help the family withstand pressure. And there are several tools that, to my knowledge, are available. The RCA produced a health directive, advanced directive, and the Aguda produced one. The main difference between the RCA and the Aguda, from my recollection, I looked at it again very briefly recently, but I remember when they came out, is the RCA is a very, very detailed, a very detailed document. And you probably need to have a doctor to help you just read through the various different options that are listed there. The Aguda approach is a much simpler approach, and that is simply appointing people who will be the health proxy, and then appointing a rabbi who will be the person to whom the family will go to take counsel and to make the decisions for the family. I would prefer something that's a little bit in between. I'll tell you why. The Aguda version is by far a far more practical version than the RCA. Because the RCA version, again, you have to understand there's so many different options, and you have to know all the different options. And the way that science goes, and the way that medical science advances, the decision we have to make now when one's young may not be by far the decisions that we'll have to make when the heir is devoid. The sheet machines will be different, the protocols will be different. So to put something into place now that's very, very specific, I think is not that that helpful. And that's why I think that the Aguda approach to appoint somebody and then to appoint somebody who will be in his place if he's not available. So I think that's much more effective and much more far-reaching. And in addition, often the wishes of the chol cannot be respected as far as halacha is concerned. And often the wishes of the chol, of the person, change. They change. When a person is young, in their 30s, their 40s, often they look at life one way. And then when they're surrounded by their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and there's a bar mitzvah coming up in a month or two, they look at life differently. So I think having flexibility and giving an overall approach is much more effective. The reason why I think that the RCA's approach has some merit, and why I would tweak the good approach, is because there are poskim, Rav Shechter, for example, who takes the wishes of the chola very much into consideration. Yibom Menachem Achayim, Rav Shlomo Zalman, and Rav Yoshev also took on very, very specific issues the wishes of the chola. But Rav Shechter is much broader in terms of taking into account the considerations of the chola. So that's why depending, psak also evolves. The way that poskim are poskening right now will probably not be entirely the same, just like we've seen psak evolve on this issue in the last 20, 25 years. So it may evolve some more. So to express what one would want to happen, and then to say but the decision making will ultimately be done by your Rav, communicated to the family. So I think that's the most effective tool. So what I would counsel is to use the Aguda form, and then to have some letter attached to it, or some note attached to it, saying that these are the wishes that I as an individual would want, but understanding that those wishes are then to be brought to the attention of the Rav, and then the Rav will, if he wants, can take that into account. I also put on the table a different strategy. It's the same idea, the same form as the Aguda form, but this was put out by Rav Elchanan Zon, who was famous for heading the strongest chevra in America, the chevra of Queens, but it goes far beyond the chevra of Queens. And he's one of the foremost experts in the area of taking care of Niftarim, Achmana Lislan. And he promotes the idea of having a card that one carries with one. Just like one can have a card that discusses the possibility of organ transplants, he has that the health director should be in one's pocket. And the reason for that is that for unusual circumstances, for a situation where a person, Rachmanos, gets in trouble and is far from home, or gets into trouble and it's on an emergency basis, so he feels that that can thwart various concerns, various problems, and that can also thwart the concern of Rachmanos Litzlan not being taken care of properly, the Acher Meir Vestrum. So I put that out also as just as a... It really is a Maram Mokom, as an indication of which website one can go to in order if one wants to pursue it that way. So those are the possibilities to use one of the health directives, to use what's called the MS card, to speak to one of the lawyers around the table. So those are all the different possibilities one has in order to deal with this Lemaase. Why is there any reason why a person should make a health care directive? Why shouldn't there be one halacha for everybody? Why isn't there an approach that Torah says, as we grew up to saying that we don't have control over these things? That's what I pointed out, the Aruch HaShulchan. In the very first page, he's the one that formulates it so succinctly. It's probably based on a Radvaz, but he says, the Kadosh Baruch Hu is the Borei Olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in control. The Rebbeinu Shlom gave us life, and the Rebbeinu Shlom will determine when and how life takes leave of us. Gemara tells Reb Chananya ben Tradyan. Reb Chananya ben Tradyan was on the post, and he was being executed. And the Romans did it in a very, very cruel fashion, where they before they put him on the stake, they wrapped him up with wet cotton, so that the fire would burn him very, very slowly and very painfully. And they wrapped him with the Sefer Torah in order to diminish all possible dignity. So the Talmidim said to Chananya ben Tradyan, they said to him, Psach Picha, open your mouth. You open your mouth and you'll inhale the smoke, and then he'll die earlier, die sooner. So he says, Misha Nosan Chayim, the one who gives life, as the one who takes life, and therefore he did not want to speed the process at all. So from that moment in Rav Chananya ben Tradyan's life, he established for us this idea that, again, is the mainstream of all poskim until very recent times, and that is that a person has to pursue all means of maintaining life, that there is no situation where a person would in any way hold back from aggressively pursuing life. And the guiding halacha is, would I be mechalel Shabbos? If a person could live for one more second, would I be mechalel Shabbos to give him another second of life? The answer is yes. If a person is in great pain and wants to live for another second, when we say b'machalo, we say, yeah, b'machalo Shabbos. B'machalo Shabbos to give a person another second, another moment of life. So if we can be machalo Shabbos for another moment of life, so then it would stand to reason that we have to aggressively pursue. We have halacha v'samad adam riecha. A person cannot stand by somebody else's dying. So irrespective of how long he'll have, and even irrespective of the quality of life, that's what I pointed out, the Minchas Chinuch is the sefer that's often referred to in terms of making this point, where the Minchas Chinuch says that if Reuven kills Shimon, with a Shimon, irrespective of the productivity of Shimon, irrespective of how much time Shimon has, irrespective of whether Shimon is a Nobel Prize laureate or whether he disparage somebody, that's something which is not so exciting. So, irrespective of that, to kill him is an isur tzicha. The prohibition of murder doesn't change. A person could be very, very ill and not have much time to go, so then Reuven will not get the death penalty. But we're not going to in any way condone or permit Reuven to do anything. So these rules, the rules of when we will violate Shabbos and the prohibition of tzicha, they communicate, number one, that we don't have ownership over life, and therefore we shouldn't have the ability to determine, we shouldn't have the right to fill in a health directive. Who are we to fill in a health directive? Figure out what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants, and there should be one standard health directive that would have been written 40, 50 years ago would be aggressive, no holds barred, do whatever everyone can for any moment of any kind of life. And whether the quality of life is a factor or not, we say, Menachas Chinuch says, no, quality of life is of no concern at all. So why is it that we would advocate nowadays to discuss the health care directive? Why is it that in the last 30, 40 years, so the tshuvas, the responses that we have, are measured differently? So it all goes back to the Ramah. The Ramah, you have it in the last page. And this is the text that which guides all poskim, how you decipher this text, more or less, with other supporting gemaras. So this Ramah is the Ramah that's speaking about a gose, a person who is on his last moments of life. Exactly what a gose is hard to define, is hard to determine, but that's not important, as you'll see in a moment, for our discussion. We don't have to define exactly what a gose is. Gemara says, with the Shulchan Aruch discussing over here, is when a person is at the end of their lives, so we don't touch them, because we're afraid that even moving them could hasten the loss of life. And then Shulchan Aruch says, and we don't tear kriya for them before. Why will Reuven's tearing the kriya affect the person who's very ill? So either it means that the person who's very ill will hear that they're already tearing kriya for him, so then he'll lose a few moments of life, or it means that Alpi Kabbalah, mystically, that if we begin to discuss what's going to happen to Yachem Eveshrim, that will speed up the passing. That's why we never discuss, no matter how diminished a person's awareness is, we never discuss what's going to be Yachem Eveshrim in front of the person who is very, very sick. Even if the doctors tell us they don't hear, they don't know what's going on, we don't take a chance on it, either because we're afraid that maybe they will hear something, they'll sense something, or perhaps mystically. The truth is that we should refrain from these conversations, even not in the presence of the chola, because of this Shulchan Aruch, HaTiftach Peh L'Satan. Sometimes arrangements have to be made, and if they're not discussed a little bit earlier, then the proper covenant mess will not take place. So sometimes, in rare circumstances, we do allow ourselves to have these conversations, and there's precedent for it. The Shulchan Aruch says, you have, that's where the Ramah says, Ein chotzvin lo kever. The Ramah is in front of you. Doesn't dig the grave until the person passed away. We know he's going to pass away. We know that he doesn't have much time, so why shouldn't we dig the grave? Because we don't do any preparation. What happens if Erev Shabbos? That's what the Shach says. So if we dig the grave, then maybe we'll be able to accomplish the Kavura before Shabbos. And we don't dig the grave, it'll be Matzoi Shabbos, it'll be Sunday. So then it's permissible. So you see that when there are circumstances which, if things don't happen now, and it could diminish the Kovod HaMeis, so then we do allow ourselves that liberty to discuss these things before the person leaves this world, but again, never in front of that person. So then the Ramah writes, V'chein Osir, is the fourth line of the Ramah, Ligrom L'meis Sheyomus Mehera. It is prohibited to cause the person who is very, very sick to die any earlier. Kegoin Mishu Goyseis Zeman Oruch, V'lo Yacholi Pored. He's a Goyseis, he's on his last breath, his chest is heaving, all those who are taking care of him are sure with the certainty that a person can have that he is going to be leaving this world, but it's taking a while. V'lo yuchal liporeid, the neshama is not able to leave this world. So osir lishomei takar v'akeses mitachtov mikoach shomrim sheyesh notzos miktsas ofos shegormim zeh. So they believed that certain kinds of feathers and certain kinds of pillows would prevent the neshama from leaving. That they were, I don't know if it was mystical, or if they had certain experiences, and so if the idea that was hovering around, well, if we'd get rid of the pillow, if we'd get rid of the feather pillow, they brought a feather pillow in 3 months ago, and because of that feather pillow, the chol is still with us today. But now it's over, so get rid of the feather pillow, and then I'll be able to leave. So you can't do that. One isn't allowed to remove the feather pillow. Even if people say that this is what is slowing down this person's demise. And he can't move the person. Even if people say, well, it's where he is right now that's keeping him going. There was a belief that if you take the keys of the shul and you put the keys of the shul under the pillow of the nifter, so that's a sign. It's telling him that he has the keys. He can, that the olam ha'emes is open to him. So that there was a practice, and I'm not sure where it came from. So halach is osir. One can't do that. One can't take the keys of the shul and put them. That's the second set. You can't take the first set. You sure can't take, but the second set you can't take and put it under his head. Why? Because that could cause him to leave this world earlier. Avol im yesh dover shegarim ikuv yitzias anefesh. If there's something which is holding back his neshama and keeping this world, sheyesh somoch also beso kol dofek. There's somebody who's chopping wood next door. The guy next door is doing construction, and all morning they're knocking, it drives everybody crazy. But the one thing it's doing, it's keeping this person, this goseis, alive, because he's drifting away, and bang. Then he hears it, and then he drifts away again, bang. So that's what's keeping him awake. So then, halacha is, then you can ask the person, could you stop chopping for a while? Could you stop the construction for a while? Oshish melach alishono, or they used to put salt on his tongue in order to keep the person alive. The elu ma'akvin yitzias anefesh, and now it's the banging of the hammer, the banging of the axe, or it's the salt on his tongue. Ma'akvin yitzias anefesh mutar lesiroi. Then you're allowed to take the salt away. You're allowed to stop the chopping. The ein b'zemase kelal elishem beisir amoyneya. This you're allowed to do. Question is, and this, by the way, comes from the Shulta Giborim. He says it comes from the Agoy Salfasi. The Shulta Giborim was Yeshua Boyas. We know Yeshua Boyas very, very well. Yeshua Boyas was an Italian godol in the 1500s. We know him well because on the side of every page of Gemara, you have on the side what's called the Mesoras HaShas. It gives you cross references to other places in Shas. That was Yeshua Boyas. You have the Torah Or. Before you had the Yochanu Boyas, not the Yochanu Boyas, the Oz V'Hodor, that puts the Pasuk on the page. So he gave you the Maramokim. Where was this Pasuk? And he put the Pasuk on the side. And then Tosfos, when Tosfos refers to a Gemara, so Tosfos himself did not give you the sighting. If Yeshua Boaz went through every Tosfos and put down which Gemara the Tosfos is referring to. And in the top right of the Yomud, when we have the reference to Shulchan Aruch, to the Rambam, that's Rabbi Yeshua Boaz. And then he did the same. Then he wrote a little bit of a lengthier comment on the Rif. And that is often referred to as either Shulta Giborim or the Hagoy Salfasi. So you can imagine Rabbi Yeshua Boaz, he didn't have, I don't think he had a Mandelkin concordance. He didn't have Bar Ilan. He didn't have a search. You can imagine what a memory the man had. You can imagine what a goy the person was, that he could go through every single page, and he could tell you which Pasuk, and where the Gemara is, and ultimately where the Rambam is. And he imagined the zechus the man has, that day in and day out, there are tens of thousands of people that are learning are getting Maramakomos because of his comments. He is also noted amongst the poskim as the first one who permitted a shetel. Until Rabbi Yeshua Boyaz, so the idea they only wore mitpachot, they only wore hats. Women did not wear shetels because the idea of having, then it wasn't polyester, nylon wasn't an option, that it was somebody else's hair. So the question was, if a woman wears somebody else's hair, is that also a problem of Gilui Rosh, of not being Mechusei Rosh? If Yeshua Boyos is the one who established that if it's somebody else's hair, then it's not a problem of not being Mechusei Rosh, not a problem of Seir B'Sherva. So he is often cited by the Poskim as the Machadesh of the concept of Sheitels. Then it was accepted by the Ramon, accepted by the Magen Avraham, and then it was debated much later on. Such a Yeshua Boyos. So here also, the Shulta Gibarim has a tremendous impact on the way that we look and we call end stage the issues that come up at the end of life. Because Yeshua Boyaz made this comment that we should, you collected these, that we should distinguish. How do we distinguish between the prohibition of causing of, you can't put the keys under his pillow, you can't take away the feather pillow, because that's keeping him alive, but to tell the guy next door to stop chopping, how can you tell him to stop chopping? We should hire a whole team of wood choppers, right? Our Cheshulchan says we're not the balabatim of a life, so we discovered how to keep this person alive. Then Minchas Chino says it doesn't matter what the quality of life is. So now we've discovered, if we get a team of choppers 24/7, we matter in Shabbos also, and the person that never to stop chopping, it'll be for as long as we can keep this going. We should hire a whole team. We should have round-the-clock chot ve'yetzim, right? You have round-the-clock shomrim. So, more important, have round-the-clock chot ve'yetzim who will keep on chopping away and keep this person alive. So how did the Shulta Gibarim say, no, this we can do. You can tell the guy to stop chopping. Somebody puts salt on his tongue, and the salt in his tongue apparently is causing him aggravation and keeping him alive. So, yeah, you can't move the person. It has to be done very delicately. Some you have to catch him when he's yawning or something and go in and get the salt, because he can't move the person. He's a ghost face. But if you can't move the person and get the salt out, oh, that you can do. Why? We should be bringing in bags of salt and getting ready. And in the moment we see that the salt gets dissolved, put some more salt there. So this issue that the Shulta Gibarim says, that the remote quotes and says, some even say you should tell the wood chopper to stop. I don't know if it made it on the page. There is a comment on the page that Beis Lechem Yehuda. So he says that. We should tell the person to stop chopping. Not just you're allowed to, but you should. So this issue, this question, is the driving question of when do we say that you cannot? You have to be aggressive. You have to. He can't do anything that will hasten a person's leaving this world. And on the other hand, we'll say that apparently there is a situation, there is time, there is a possibility of telling a person, stop chopping the wood, let the person leave this world. So when you figure that out, that becomes the way that we formulate when do we allow a person to say that either they don't want this kind of a life, or that they've had enough, or whatever it is. We can figure that out, right? Because the question is, there is an Iser of Lo Yisamal Adam Riecha. You can't let a person go. So tell the guy to keep on chopping. He's not a Bal Dover. So the remote quote gives us the hint. And it's a rephrasing of the Shulta Gibarim Yeshua Boyaz, and he says the last few words: "The ain bozeh maasek kalal elashem veisir hamoineya," because here you're not doing something; you're just removing the thing which is stopping him from dying. Right? I can't cause a person to leave this world sooner, but if there's something which is artificially keeping him alive, then I'm allowed to remove that which is keeping him alive. Right, so now how do you expand that? Now Rabbi Perel said, where does it come from? How did he know this? So there are two or three sources that would indicate, despite what the Aruch HaShulchan said, and despite what the Minchas Chinuch said, that we have no ownership over life I have to leave it up to God. And despite what the Minchas Chinuch said, that the quality of life doesn't matter, we have other sources that indicate otherwise. Right? So Rabbi Perel said, the same Rabbi Hananya ben Trajan, the same story. The first part of the story is the Talmidim say to him, open your mouth, yawn, breathe in, you'll breathe in smoke, and you'll leave this world soon, and you'll be able to get over this pain. But the end of the story is that the Roman executioner says, he says, can I take the cotton away? Can I take the wet cotton away? And Hananya ben Trajan says, if you take the wet cotton, the Romans put wet cotton in order to slow the impact of the fire on his body and to keep him suffering longer. So Hananya ben Trajan says to the Roman, if you'll take the wet cotton away, then I'll bring you into Olam Haba with me. So the Roman did that. So how could Hananya ben Trajan tell the Talmidim, I'm not going to hasten my death, I'm not going to breathe in the smoke, but if the Roman wants to take away the wet, fine. Not only is it fine, I'm going to encourage him to do it. I'm going to tell him and give him a place with me. So how do we put the two together? So apparently, the Shulta Giborim held, the difference was because if he breathes in, he's causing actively his own death. He's killing himself. He's killing himself by breathing in the smoke, by breathing the fire. But the wet cotton is what's preventing the fire from consuming him. So if you remove the wet cotton, that allows the fire to do what it's doing. If you tell the guy to stop chopping, then the natural sleep, which is taking over this person, will happen. So that might be, another source might be the famous Imsei de Rebbe, that the Aruch HaShulchan, the maidservant of Rebbe, Gemara says that Rebbe was suffering terribly. Rebbe Anossi had a terrible, terrible stomach ailment. And he was suffering apparently for a long time. But then it came finally to the end of his life. He was suffering. He couldn't leave his home. And the Talmidim gathered together and davened 24/7 for him. They kept on davening for him. And he was suffering terribly. And finally, at some point, the maidservant of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi couldn't take it anymore. So she went to the window and she threw something out. And when the Talmidim saw something coming at them, so they were stunned, they were shocked, they ran for cover. And they couldn't daven for a few seconds. And then Gemara says that's when the Malachim were able to get the soul of Rabbi Yehuda Anossi. So some suggest that it's a good story, and it really shows the power of prayer, the power of tefillah, and that's it. Because she was a maidservant. Maybe she did the wrong thing. Maybe she did a terrible thing by allowing us to lose Rabbi Yehuda Anossi sometime earlier. Others say, why would the Gemara record it? If the Gemara recorded it, they say nice things about Amsid Rabbi. There are other Gemaras that Amsid Rabbi Anossi, his maidservant hanging around Rabbi Anossi, she knew a lot of words. She was helped the Chacham understand certain things. So they seem to have a good thing to say about her. Sometimes when Chazal say this guy was a terrible person, but he did a very good thing, then they say Zachor Oso Ish Latov. He's a bad guy. He did a good thing, right? So if Amsud Rabbi Yehuda Anossi was really a bad person, and she killed Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, but she was also a person who helped us interpret certain words, they would say Zocher Os Ish L'Tov. She did some good. They don't say that. They say she seems to be a good person. So that leads Svarim to point out number one, a very important idea: if a person is suffering terribly, can one ask the Rabbonu Shel Olam to relieve the person of his suffering? Right? Can we ask? So that's the Aruch HaShulchan says that sometimes you see from this Gemara, that's as far as he takes the Gemara. Sometimes a person, one's allowed to daven, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu should relieve him their suffering. Yep. But the some Svarim take it a step further and say Rabbi Yehuda Anossi was destined to leave this world. There was something that was holding back, and that was the prayers of all of these students. So Amsud Rabbi Yehuda Anossi figured out what Hananya ben Trajan told the goy: if you remove that which is stopping the neshama from leaving, that's okay. And that might be another source for this distinction. Yeah.
They ultimately davened that he should die.
Yeah.
So you allowed him to die for someone to die when under the circumstances.
And, okay, okay.
And two, why can't you say it's because it's a gun?
Could be. That's what some sources say. Yeah.
Because,
yeah. Correct.
You see, there are many doses that talk about
yeah.
that when a guy does something like with Gamaliel, he couldn't do that with Azara, but a guy gave him those images,
yeah.
doses that it's okay.
Yeah.
So you see a guy, and it's maybe different that
yeah.
you couldn't do that.
Right. I think Rav Moshe points it out that you can't that the story of Rav Hanania ben Tranyan is not an ironclad proof, because it could be that we are more liberal, even though this is not generally correct, that we are more liberal with a goy, the prohibition of murder that a non-Jew has, than the prohibition of lo samo dam riach. It's possible, although we are generally stricter with the prohibition of ritzicha of a non-Jew than a Jew. So it would not be consistent, but there are poskim who say that you cannot bring a proof from that. And that's why, at the end of the day, it's this Ramah that is the driving text. Because the Amsud Rebbe Yehuda, you could answer, you could say it's prayer, it's the Tameid sermon. Rav Hananya ben Tran, you could say it's a goy. You could say, the Chassam Sofer says, he has an interesting idea. He says that you're allowed to tell the murderer to murder you more pain, quicker. He says, that's the Chiddush. He was the murderer. He's doing it anyway. So you can tell a murderer, please murder, you got to do it anyways. Let's make this less painful. The Gemara says that Ula had a friend who was murdered by Ben Chuzoi. So and Ula was there apparently. So after they murdered his friend, so Ula said, ask the murderer, let's make this as quick as possible. So why did he say that? So the Chassam Sofer says, that's a different kind of a din. So the point that we're making is that if not for this text of the Ramah, so we would still be at a loss as to whether we would still say there is never any liberal approach to letting go of a person's life. We have to, we're not balabatim, we don't own life, and we would sit back and say, we've got to be totally aggressive as much as possible. And all the different Gemaras, they would not be convincing, because we would say, I can't take a chance in it. Maybe those Gemaras, in those particular cases, they did pursue allowing the person to leave this world earlier because it was a goy, because it was davening. But once the Ramah makes this comment, the Ramah for Ashkenazi Jewry is the final, broadest authority. Right? So once the Ramah makes the comment and he codifies this comment to the Shulta Giborim, so then it becomes a directive for Klal Yisrael. But you have to figure it out, though. You have to figure it out, and then have to figure out how you apply that in modern terms. So Rav Moshe's application of this, Rav Moshe said that all of this, and all this again, so what are we, with the final step of today's shir? First we began with the practice with Allah Lamasa of the healthcare directives, then we raised the question of why should we be writing a healthcare directive altogether? How could we take ownership over this part of life? And is there any reason to in any way express what a person's wishes are? So it comes down to this text. And this text says there are situations where we would tell the wood chopper to stop chopping, where we would remove the salt because that person we would say in modern terms, is in an irreversible situation. At that point they thought this person is not going to be returned to life. So that's what we use the same phrase nowadays. If the doctors say that this is an irreversible situation, that there is literally no precedent of this person making it back, that there is no pattern, no scientific pattern that could suggest that this person will be restored, where we say, Alpi derech ha-teva, as far and as broad as we know, natural processes, he's in an irreversible situation. And the issue right now is just whether it's going to be this week, next week, when it's going to happen. So the Shulchan Aruch says, well, then if there's something which is preventing him from dying, then you don't have to prevent him from dying. So Rav Moshe says there's one major issue over here. And Rav Moshe uses this as a very, very important part of the psak. Rav Moshe says, if you look at the comment on the side, the Beis Lechem Yehuda, he says, when the neshama leaves this world, it's under a lot of pain. B'shas, she'ein tzolikin, b'shas yitzias neshama, k'dei shalot tachsa neshama v'tizbol yisurim koshim. Quotes, I think, a Sefer HaChassidim. That when a person's leaving this world, one shouldn't, that's not, then he says, one shouldn't, at the last few moments, that's not a good time, it's oak to cry to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Why? Because if the neshama is already on its way out, then bring it back in causes a lot of pain. The neshama to leave this world is a painful thing. So the Rav Moshe says that's what's happening in this comment. Number one, irreversible. Number two, the chol is in great pain. So then when a chol is in great pain, then we are, Rav Moshe even takes a very, then he says it's even prohibited to prolong a life of pain. Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Yoshua do not use such strong terms. They do not say it is prohibited. They say one is allowed to let a person die, again, if it's irreversible, and if what we're going to accomplish will only be a life of pain. And then Rav Shlomo Zalman takes one step further. As Rav Shlomo Zalman says, we have two different views. Rav Breisha says that the upshot of this text is that if keeping a person alive, a person is dying, irreversible, and I believe Rav Moshe would say he applies it in situations where the person is not alert, he doesn't have, in our terms, any productive or time. Any time when he's at all interacting with this world, and he's in pain, so then one is allowed to let nature take its course in that case. Why? Because this is all talking about the context of Yusurin. Rav Shlomo Zalman, Yerushalmi, different approach. He says pain is a horrible, horrible thing, but when the person gets the Olam HaEmes, then all the pain he had in this world will bring him tremendous reward. Rav Shlomo Zalman says there's a Gemara in Sota where the woman who is a Sota, and she did what she shouldn't have done, and she denied it, and we erased God's name, and because of that, because she was in violation of the family, and she denied it, and caused God's name to be erased and drank it, so now she begins to waste away. So the Gemara says, if she was a Marsha, she has nothing good in her to speak for, then she wastes away right away. But if she has some zchuyos, right? If that's what the Gemara says, it's good for a woman to learn, because if she gets into trouble, she becomes a sota, so then she'll have this chus of learning, so she'll die slowly. So it could take 2-3 years. The Gemara says it could be other zchuyos, other kinds of things in her. So the Meforshim say, to die slowly? That's a zchus. The schus would be bang, right? Drink and finished, right? And if she's a terrible, terrible person with no redeeming quality, no, so then she should linger. So Shlomo Zalman says, no, you see from the Gemara that there's a tremendous value to Yisurin. That Yisurin in this world, they're horrible, they totally devastating, but they'll have a value in the Olam HaEmes. So Shlomo Zalman's approach is we should not be so quick to make decisions based on the person's pain. However, what he writes is that you explain to the chola. This is where Shlomo Zalman says that the chola gets to determine. The chola gets to determine that if does he want the pain or not. Shlomo Zalman's approach was explain to the chola if he's in the right frame of mind and the right person. There are zechuyos, there are merits, but we know it's terribly painful. You decide. If you decide that person is person could be has to be an irreversible situation. Let's say a person is having, I'll make it two few easy situations. A person has recurring heart failure, and he's revived, and then 10 hours later another heart, and then 10 hours another heart failure. He has either there's a tremendous fluid on the chest, or maybe he has a tumor in the chest, a tumor in the heart, and the doctors say this is what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that he's going to continuously have heart failure. We'll bring him back with the paddles or with the medication, and it'll be for a few hours and then again, until finally the heart can't come back anymore. So do we have to go through all of these steps? So Rav Moshe would say, well, if he's in pain, we should not bring him back. Rav Shlomo Zalman would say, ask him what he wants. Did he want the pain or not? If he doesn't want the pain, so then we would be allowed not to bring him back. Well, Yosha made a similar comment. So that would be something where, in a health care directive, a person would say that they do not want, once life has become, would say, no longer alert, no longer responsive, and they're in pain, so then the person may say, this will help the rabbi make a decision. Because he maybe follows Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach. And then...
What does Rav Shlomo Zalman hold about for other people? Because the person is allowed to make the choice for himself. What about if someone has to choose for somebody else?
So Rav Shlomo Zalman, it sounds like that he would be very hesitant to make that decision. Right? But it also sounds like that in times he did make the decision. What Rav Shlomo Zalman did say, in other words, we have a few... tshuvas in this, they're all very, very specific responses, specific situations. So sometimes it's hard to be as precise as would Rav Shlomo Zalman make the decision of somebody else ever. So I can't say that. I've seen sometimes where he's written "Let it go," and sometimes where he said, "Well, pain is not so terrible, not bad." Right? Ultimately, when the person can't decide on their own, when we can't decide, but the Rav Shlomo Zalman's. And this is where there's a very significant difference between, let's say, the approach of, I usually point out that there are three general approaches in this area. One is an approach to be aggressive, never to stop, to employ all means that are allowed. And that says about this, we don't really work with this shulta kiborim. When is it called hasaras moneya? A person has a recurring pneumonia, and they're on IVs, and we can't get the right antibiotic, and we've tried all antibiotics, and the person has end stage lung disease. So do we have to keep on trying more and more? A person has end stage heart failure. A person has already exhausted all the different protocols for chemotherapy. And do we have to try experimental chemotherapy? Do we have to try different kinds of protocols? So there are those who would say, Loisamet al dam reyecha. Those who say, we're not balabatim, let go. Keep on going. That's one approach. Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach is a middle approach. And it's based, I believe, when I'm now speculating, because what I'm saying right now is not so clearly in writing. But Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach is that if we are allowed to let the disease process which is killing him, we're allowed to let that happen. But if there's some other ailment which comes, or there are natural provisions that we should be providing the person, we have to maintain that. Rav Shlomo Zalman says you always have to feed a chola. You always have to give the chola oxygen. Rav Shlomo Zalman says if he needs insulin, he's been on insulin for the last 30, 40 years, you have to keep him on insulin. Even though by removing the insulin, we could speed his death. Can't do that. Rav Shlomo Zalman says if he has, in the case that I gave him pneumonia, you have to give him antibiotics. All of these, so these are things which Shlomo Zalman says, those are part of keeping a person alive. They're not holding it back from dying. On the other hand, if his heart is giving way and it'll be irreversible, and bringing it back means we'll bring it back only for a short period of time, we are allowed to let the heart go. If a person can't breathe, he has heart failure, he can't breathe, do we have to put him on oxygen? Do we have to intubate? Right. So this, by the way, also is important to Aura, that just like we said before, giving broad rules sometimes, or writing rules that are very specific, and allowing them to be applied in every situation. So those are often not a good thing to do. For example, if a person would write that they never wanted DNR. They would always, whenever they're a candidate, they want a DNR. All right, that's the right. That would be in their health directive. So that would not be a smart thing to do. Why? Because it depends on the hospital. There are certain hospitals that, when they see DNR, then they don't treat. It becomes a DNT. It depends on the hospital. So it could be that in one hospital one could sign a DNR, in the other hospital one can never sign a DNR because it's interpreted in the hospital in a different way. And that's why the good health proxy is just much more pliable. And I believe much more useful. But coming back to Shlomo Zalman's approach, so Shlomo Zalman says that if what's killing him is the continuation of the disease, the tumor is growing, the cancer in the blood is not being responsive, and that continues, and the tumor is now throwing clots. And those clots are going to cause the heart failure. You're allowed to let the clots. You do not have to give him anticoagulants. You don't have to stop the clots because the disease is progressing. Now the disease has come to the point where it's throwing clots. He can let it go. All right. However, if the person has sepsis, right? And now this person goes into then throws a clot, and then this person goes into heart failure, and the doctors will say the two are unrelated. This episode of heart failure is unrelated to the sepsis. I mean, I'm not saying that what I'm saying is medically correct, but if that would be the scenario, so then we would say you have to respond to the heart failure, because that's not hasoras moneia. What's killing this person is the sepsis. So you're allowed to let the sepsis continue. To stop the sepsis, sepsis is being moneia, and is stopping it, stopping what is going to take his life. So you're allowed not to stop it. But then something comes from left field, another disease process that you have to deal with, because that may be reversible. His disease process, his sepsis is irreversible. The doctors have tried all sorts of heavy-duty antibiotics, and not working. So at that point, you're allowed to let the sepsis and its ramifications happen. But if something happens, which the doctors say that is a reversible situation, he now gets a UTI, right? A uterine infection, and that antibiotics will take care of. So maybe we'll keep him around for another few hours, another day. So then we have to deal with UTI. If the doctors say no, the UTI is part of the sepsis. So then you don't have to deal with it. So that was Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach, because he interpreted this Gemara as saying that the person is dying. Now what's keeping him alive is the chopping of the wood. So then you can let the person die. But if we figure something else out, something else happens to him, you have to deal with it. And Rav Shlomo Zalman said you always have to provide food and drink and ongoing attention that he's had until now. I would point out in Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach, so there are, I would make three points. Number one, Rav Shlomo Zalman does accept psychological pain. He equates that with physical pain. He's holy nefesh. If a person is depressed, he equates depression. Depression is also pain. That is a chiddush which others, I don't think, record. Rav Shlomo Zalman goes as far as to say, as a life without dignity, for some people, is terribly painful and can be taken into account. Rav Shlomo Zalman is a tshuva, an amazing tshuva, and has to always be taken into account by a poseg of a person who, Rachmanu Litzlan, has a gangrenous leg in the leg, and the doctors say the only way he has a chance to live is via amputation. So you saw the Moruk Tzir, Yaakov Emden says if a person makes a decision that he doesn't want to undergo a procedure because it's terribly painful for him, but that's going to because he'll lose his life, we don't take that into account. He's not a Baal HaBos. We would remove the leg. So Shlomo Zalman has a tshuva where he says that this person has thought it through, and he looks at life, and he says that for him, the lack of dignity he's going to have, being wheelchair bound, whatever it is, it's a very short tshuva. Then he says, you have to take it very seriously. So he doesn't say they're allowed to let the person go, but he clearly is willing to respect a person's feelings of being hopelessly undignified. And that's again a chiddush, which is what I'm saying, is that's why I would tweak the aguda directive, because for all we know, in 20 years, that chiddush of Shlomo Zalman could be totally dismissed, and it'll be a comment in the Mincha Shlomo that no one's dealing with, or for all we know, it could become a very significant part of the way that some poskim will be thinking. So that's number one. Number two is Rav Shlomo Zalman takes the position, which I personally do not understand, that when he says we have to provide food, he means, even if it means a feeding tube, and even if it means a peg. So that I find very difficult for two reasons. Number one is that feeding is natural. I have trouble saying that a peg is natural feeding and not a medical procedure. Right, putting a tube directly into the stomach to provide nourishment and nutrition, so I have trouble evaluating that as natural feeding and not as medication. And number two, the reason why it may be a moot point is because when a peg is being put in temporarily to get a person over temporary weakness, a temporary problem, so that we can then deal with the machla, so then we can often provide the person with many, many years ahead. It's there for a short period of time to give him strength, get him up for a certain procedure, and he's ready for the procedure. On the other hand, when the doctors say the peg is going in, and chance of the peg being taken out is not likely. So then what I've been told is that the longevity with the peg is not significantly increased because of all the different side effects, because of infections, because of the possibility of what's it called when the lungs...
Aspiration.
So it may be a moot point, but I have difficulty with this position of Rav Shlomo Zalman and Tzorech Iyun. And Rav Shlomo Zalman's approach that we always give antibiotics, so I would think that Rav Shlomo Zalman would not say that, again I have to ask the Talmidim, if it's a situation where the person is becoming, let's say a person is dying of pneumonia, and we give him antibiotics, and he doesn't have any quality of life, and he's in bed, and he's determined to have a reversible pneumonia. We'll give him the antibiotics, and he'll get the, and it's happened. He's continuously come back into the hospital every week. Antibiotics goes home. So at some point, Rav Shlomo Zalman in writing seems to say you still got to get the antibiotics. I'm not sure, because at that point, the pneumonia is killing him. And the antibiotics are the wood chopper. So Tzorech Iyun. There is the third approach they referred to. Rav Shechter's approach is gives a person greater autonomy. Rav Shechter very much takes into account whether a person's quality of life is of something that most people would want. Rav Shechter's approach is that if a person says, "I only want to get better if I can." I can dance at every chasana. I only want to get better if I can play ball with my grandchildren. I only want to get better if I can make every shachris mincha marv and go to keep my seder and learn daf. So then we say, "I'm sorry, you have that your quality of life that you expect is not reasonable, and we're going to force you to take the procedure, even though it means that you won't be able to maintain the life that you expect. You won't be able to travel to Europe anymore during the summers. You have to stay home a little bit longer." So we say, "I'm sorry." Right? On the other hand, if a person's expectations are within normal expectations, so then and a person says this is the kind of life he does not want anymore, and it's a Rav Shechter would say it's a reasonable thing to say, so then he would be he would allow at that point not to aggressively pursue treatment. So what is the basis? I can't say that I've heard this from Rav Shechter, but I would suggest, based on other shiurim that I've heard from Rav Shechter, is that we do find in halacha that a person does have there is a source in halacha which does give people greater autonomy than the source we've mentioned until now. And that is what profession a person can pursue. Halach is, and this will close. The halach is a person says, ever since he was a kid, he wanted to be a fireman. Right? And now, he's already He's 18. He's an independent guy. He can't stop him anymore. He's going to seek to find a dangerous thing. That's a dangerous thing to do. So, will the Rav say you can't become a fireman because the Kodesh Nefoshes? A guy says he wants to become a window washer. He says, no problem. We wear belts. And I only want to do the top three floors. I'm going to become a specialist. I only do penthouses, right? So will the Rav say you're crazy? You want to wash windows? So you do storefronts. You have to go up. So the Gemara says that if Kevin should doshu be rabim, if it's a risk that people accept, one's allowed to accept that kind of a risk. And the Gemara says that that's why when Chumash says you have to pay a person on time, you have an employee, you have to pay him on time, because it's keilovu noseyas nafsho, because he's looking for you, he's looking to you. The Gemara says because he's giving his life up for you. The Gemara says because sometimes a professional is giving his life up. He's doing crazy things. Who gave him the right to do crazy things? We should tell him, I'm sorry. He can't take such a risk. So the Gemara says a person is allowed to take a risk. So you see that there are situations where a person is allowed to take a risk of his own life if people take that risk. Winter time, we get a good snowstorm. So what's the heter to go skiing? Heter is because it's a sport that is obviously they couldn't afford to keep the snow coming artificially if it wouldn't be a good parnassus. There must be enough people who are doing a certain sport in order to make the sport. A person wants to do adventure jumping, right? The when they slide down on a small disc or something in the Olympics, whatever. So a person to that, you can say, "I'm sorry, that's osir. That's osir, because that is if you don't have dosha rami. A few people who don't have much to live for, they figure, right? So they do these things, but you can't do that. But if it's a dosha be rabim, people, a significant number of people." Accept this kind of a risk, then it's permissible. Not mechuyev, you don't have to do it. Permissible. So you do see that Torah does accord us some autonomy. So I think Rav Schechter comes from that angle, if it's doshu be'rabim, if this is a risk, if this is that it is within a person's thinking to take ownership over their life for these kinds of situations, then it would be permissible. So I seek a summary of what we said. Is that when it comes to decisions, Rav Schechter recently said that this has become one of the most common shilas nowadays. Again, you think this, how things change. And one of the most common shilas nowadays is end-of-life care. So the three different positions that you find in the Sfarim are the position of absolutely, totally aggressive, all-heroic measures. And that's based on the Aruch HaShulchan and the Menachos Chaim that we began with, and dismisses other sources. The other extreme is that a person can take a significant degree of ownership over their life, and they say, if there's a life that they don't want to live, and it's within reason, as most people would determine, it could be the medical community would make that determination, because they have access to huge numbers of people in this situation. So then a person's allowed to say, had enough, I do not want to proceed with a certain course of treatment. And then you have what I would think is a mainstream approach, which is that given certain situations, given pain, given irreversibility, given a lack of, a severe lack of quality, given an undignified, not being able to do any mitzvah whatsoever, not being able to have any pleasure at all, not being responsive at all. So in that situation, we would still have to provide the things that are natural, but we could refrain from trying to beat the disease process as we understand it. We would still have to treat a random diseases that may come in the way, but the disease process we'd be allowed to, and that would be based on this remor that we are allowed to, and maybe even we are allowed to ask the wood chopper to stop chopping. Questions, comments, especially from the medical people? Go ahead.
The top of the
So I think the reason why that's not essential for us is because he's making a decision in the context of being executed, but in the context of what's permissible or not, so then he does not maintain that distinction. So I think even he says, and that's when we say a ghost is chay l'chol davar, he means he says it's even for l'sano dam riach, I think, for that we would say.
I don't know if this is a medical profession, but I know it.
You're an EMT, so it's okay. I have very broad standards.
We're taught that DNR
yeah.
does not mean DNT.
Yeah.
And that's a given. It's something that's our discretion that we can decide, well, our policy is going to be where it says DNR, we're not going to treat.
Okay.
If we are faced with a situation where a person has DNR, they're having difficulty breathing, we have to put oxygen.
Right. So first of all, in the ambulance, it's very rare that these decisions are they even aware of any documentation. That's why so much of this is very theoretical.
When you come to a house.
Unless they have it there, right. But that's because you've been trained in Bergenfield, Paramus, and Teaneck. But there are hospitals of lesser reputation, and I'm not saying they're following the correct protocol. But if it's an overstaffed hospital, they give you a scenario: an overstaffed hospital understaffed hospital, everybody's under a tremendous amount of pressure, and there are ill people in the corridor. So then, if there's a patient that is a DNR, then they will respond to others. They shouldn't be doing it, and it's bad, and the protocol is bad, but I've seen it, and I've been told that this is a reality in certain situations. So that's the kind of thing where a person is stuck in a hospital. And it could be Rahman January 1st, right? They couldn't they just don't have the staff to take care of it. So you always have to know that you don't have to assume, but you do have to make the inquiry as in this when does have to discuss with the doctor, will it be respected as a DNR and not become a DNT, I think. Good?
I think it means the approach of the team. Sometimes in the hospital you see somebody with DNR, DNI, the team might the understaff they might interpret that as the family doesn't want us really to resuscitate. So if they have a code, we'll take the DNI. If they have a code, well, we'll give a half effort. And then if
yeah.
they can get the patient back right away on the first round,
Well, that's assuming the code.
But that's what this is. So you have a DNI on a patient, not necessarily a DNR, because it's easier to think about. So you don't want to intubate the patient. So the team takes that as an interpretation. Okay, well,
try twice.
Very serious about us resuscitating the patient. We'll give one shot at it. If we can't get him back, we'll...
Wouldn't happen at Cornell, but you can imagine it.
Right.
Good.
I don't know the question, but the example that Roma gave, the salt and the chopping, those are more like bug mices, and they're not real treatments, so it's hard to make a jump that also the Roma says, you don't tell the guy you can stop chopping. Is that really analogous with saying you don't have to actually treat the disease before you have actual medical
Right. That's why it's difficult. That's why one has to go into the thinking of the Roma. But you're saying it's correct. If we wouldn't have, the Rama wouldn't have at the end, the Ein B'zeh Ma'aseh Klal, right? If we wouldn't have the Darchei Moshe, which is the basis of the, where he's even more elaborate, then we'd have to be concerned that the Rama would say, you know what, wood chopping, keeping the guy alive, it's not doing anything anyways. But that's not the logic he gives us. So because the Rama in that time, they thought that this was effective, so we have to then upgrade using his logic. But that is the work that has to be done over here to figure out to conceptualize the Rama and then apply it. That's correct. It could be, yeah, and it may have worked. It could be the standard. Kadosh Baruch Hu could use different things to use at different times.